the old-fashioned brass pipe against the side of the boat, a habit that had worn a small trough in a certain spot on the gunwale. It was because he prized his ship so greatly that he had decided to forego his pipe every other day and smoke New Life cigarettes instead, carving himself a coral holder for the purpose. Jukichi turned his eyes away from the two youths and, the coral holder clamped between his teeth, gazed out over the misty expanse of the Gulf of Ise. Cape Moro, at the tip of Chita Peninsula, was faintly visible through the mist. Jukichi Oyama's face was like leather. The sun had burned it almost black down to the very bottom of its deep wrinkles, and it gleamed like polished leather. His eyes were sharp and full of life, but they had lost the clarity of youth and in its place seemed to have been glazed with the same tough dirt that coated his skin, making them able to withstand any light, no matter how brilliant. Because of his age and his great experience as a fisherman, he knew how to wait tranquilly. Now he said, "I know exactly what you two are thinking. You're planning to give Yasuo a beating, but you listen to me. That won't do a bit of good. A fool's a fool, so just leave him alone. Guess it's hard for Shinji, but patience is the main thing. That's what it takes to catch a fish. Everything's going to be all right now, for sure. Right's sure to win, even if it doesn't say anything. Uncle Teru's no fool, and don't you ever think he can't tell a fresh fish from a rotten one. Just you leave Yasuo alone. Right's sure to win in the end." Even though it was always a day late, village gossip reached the lighthouse together with the daily deliveries of mail and food. And the news that Terukichi had forbidden Hatsue to see Shinji turned Chiyoko's heart black with feelings of guilt. She comforted herself with the thought that Shinji did not know she was the source of this false gossip. But even so, she simply could not look Shinji in the eye when he came one day to bring fish, completely cast down in spirits. And on the other hand, her good-natured parents, not knowing the reason, were worried over Chiyoko's moroseness. Chiyoko's spring vacation was drawing to a close, and the day came when she was to return to her dormitory in Tokyo. She simply could not bring herself to confess what she had done, and yet she had the feeling that she could not return to Tokyo until she asked Shinji to forgive her. If she did not confess her guilt, there was no particular reason for Shinji to be angry with her, but still she wanted to beg his pardon. So she got herself invited to spend the night before her departure for Tokyo at the house of the postmaster in the village, and before dawn the next morning she went out alone. The beach was already busy with preparations for the day's fishing, and people were going about their work in the starlight. The boats, pulled on the abacus frames and urged on by many shouting voices, inched reluctantly down toward the water's edge. Nothing could be seen distinctly except the white of the towels and sweat cloths the men had tied around their heads. Step by step, Chiyoko's wooden clogs sank into the cold sand, and in its turn the sand slithered whisperingly off the arches of her feet. Everyone was busy and no one looked at Chiyoko. She realized with a pang of shame that here all these people were, caught fast in the monotonous but powerful whirlpool of earning a daily living, burning out the very depths of their bodies and souls, and that not one of them was the sort of person who could become engrossed in sentimental problems such as hers. Nevertheless, Chiyoko peered eagerly through the dawn's darkness, looking for Shinji. All the men were dressed alike, and it was difficult to distinguish their faces in the morning twilight. One boat finally hit the waves and floated on the water as though it had been freed from cramped confinement. Instinctively, Chiyoko moved toward it and then called out to a young man with a white towel tied around his head. The youth had been about to jump aboard, but now he stopped and turned back. His smiling face revealed the whiteness of two clean rows of teeth, and Chiyoko knew for certain it was Shinji.
"I'm leaving today. I wanted to say goodbye."
"Oh, you're leaving?" Shinji fell silent, and then, in an unnatural tone of voice, as though he were trying to decide what would be best to say, he added, "Well, goodbye." Shinji was in a hurry. Realizing this, Chiyoko felt even more hurried than he. No words would come, much less a confession. She closed her eyes, praying that Shinji would stay before her even 1 second more. In this moment, she realized that her wanting to beg his pardon was actually nothing but a mask to conceal her long-felt desire to have him be kind to her. What was it she was wanting to be forgiven for, this girl who was so convinced of her ugliness? On the spur of the moment, without thought, she let slip the question she had always kept pushed down in the very bottom of her heart, a question she probably could never have asked anyone but this one boy.
Shinji, am I so ugly?
What? The boy asked, a puzzled look on his face.
My face, is it so ugly?
Chiyoko hoped the dawn's darkness would protect her face, making her appear even the slightest bit beautiful. But the sea to the east, didn't it seem to be already turning light? Shinji's answer was immediate. Being in a hurry, he escaped a situation in which too slow an answer would have cut into the girl's heart. What makes you say that? You're pretty, he said, one hand on the stern and one foot already beginning the leap that would carry him into the boat. You're pretty. As everyone well knew, Shinji was incapable of flattery. Now, pressed for time, he had simply given a felicitous answer to her urgent question. The boat began to move. He waved back to her cheerfully from the boat as it pulled away. And it was a happy girl who was left standing at the water's edge. Later that morning, her parents came down from the lighthouse to see her off, and even while she talked with them, Chiyoko's face was full of life. They were surprised to see how happy their daughter was to be returning to Tokyo. The Kamikaze Maru pulled away from the jetty, and Chiyoko was finally alone on the warm deck. In the solitude, her feeling of happiness, on which she had been pondering constantly all morning, became complete.
He said I'm pretty. He said I'm pretty.
Chiyoko repeated yet again the refrain she had said over and over to herself how many hundreds of times since that moment.
That's really what he said, and that's enough for me.
I mustn't expect more than that. That's really what he said to me. I must be satisfied with that and not expect him to love me too.
He has someone else to love. What a wicked thing it was I did to him. What terrible unhappiness my jealousy has caused him, and yet he repaid my wickedness by saying I'm pretty. I must make it up to him. Somehow I must do whatever I can to return his kindness.
Chiyoko's reveries were broken by a strange sound of singing that drifted across the waves. When she looked, she saw a fleet of boats, covered with red banners, sailing from the direction of the Irako Channel.
What are those?
Chiyoko asked the captain's young assistant, who was coiling a hawser to the deck.
They're pilgrim boats bound for the Ise shrines. The fishermen from Enshu and Yaizu on Suraga Bay bring their families with them on the Bonito boats to Toba. All those red flags have the boats' names on them. They have a great time drinking and singing and gambling all the way.
The red banners became more and more distinct, and as the fast ocean-going fishing boats drew near the Kamikaze Maru, the singing voices borne on the wind were almost raucous. Once more, Chiyoko repeated to herself,
"He told me I'm pretty."
Chapter 12. In this way, the spring had neared its end. It was still too early for the clusters of crinum lilies that bloomed in the cliffs on the eastern side of the island, but the fields were colored here and there with various other flowers. The children were back in school again, and some of the women were already diving in the cold water for the seaweed called soft lace. As a consequence, there were now more houses that were empty during the daytime, doors unlocked, windows open. Bees entered these empty houses freely, flew about in them lonesomely, and were often startled upon running headlong into a mirror. Shinji, not clever at scheming, had been able to discover no way to meet Hatsue. Although their meetings before had been few and far between, still the happy anticipation of their next meeting had made the waiting bearable. But now that he knew there could be no next meeting, his longing to see her became even stronger. and yet the promise he had given Jukichi not to loaf made it impossible for him to take even a day off from fishing. So there was nothing for him to do every night after he returned from fishing but to wait until the streets were empty and then prowl about the neighborhood of Hatsue's house. Sometimes an upstairs window would be thrown open and Hatsue would look out. Except on those lucky occasions when the moon was shining just right, her face was lost in the shadows. Even so, the boy's sharp eyesight allowed him to see clearly even how her eyes were wet with tears. Out of fear of the neighbors, Hatsue never spoke, and Shinji too, from behind the stone wall of the small vegetable garden at the back of her house, would simply stand looking up at the girl's face, not saying a word. Without fail, the letter Ryuji would bring the next day would dwell at great length upon the pain of such an ephemeral meeting, and as Shinji read the words, Hatsue's image and voice would finally come into focus together, and in his mind, the wordless girl he had seen the night before would come alive with speech and action. Such meetings were painful for Shinji, too, and there were times when he preferred to relieve his pent-up emotions by wandering to those parts of the island where people seldom came. Sometimes he went as far as the ancient burial mound of Prince Deki. The exact boundaries of the tumulus were not clear, but at the highest point there were 7 ancient pine trees and, in the midst of them, a small torii and shrine. The legend of Prince Deki was vague. Nothing was known even about the origins of his strange name. In a time-honored ceremony held during the Lunar New Year, the strange box that reposed in the shrine was briefly opened each year, and old couples of more than 60 years of age were allowed a fleeting glimpse of the object it contained, which looked like an ancient nobleman's fan-shaped baton, but no one knew what relationship there was between this mysterious treasure and Prince Deki. Until about a generation passed, the children of the island had called their mothers Ea, and this was said to have arisen from the fact that the prince had called his wife Hea, meaning room, and that his infant heir had mispronounced the word as Ea when trying to imitate his father. Be that as it may, the story goes that long, long ago, in a golden ship, the prince drifted from a far land to this island, took a girl of the island to wife, and when he died, was buried in an imperial tumulus. No accounts have been handed down concerning the prince's life, nor are there recounted any of those tragic tales that are apt to grow up and adhere to such a legendary figure. Assuming the legend to be based on fact, this silence suggests that Prince Deki's life on Utajima must have been so happy and uneventful that it left no room for the birth of tragic yarns. Perhaps Prince Deki was a heavenly being who descended to a nameless land. Perhaps he lived out his earthly years without being recognized and, do what he would, will as he could, was never separated from happiness, nor from the blessings of heaven. Perhaps this is the reason why his remains were interred in a mound overlooking the beautiful 5-league beach and Hachijo Isle, leaving behind not a single story. But the boy knew only unhappiness as he wandered about the shrine until exhausted. Then he sat down absent-mindedly on the grass, hugged his knees and gazed out at the moonlit sea. There was a halo around the moon, foretelling rain on the morrow. The next morning, when Ryuji stopped by Hatsue's house to pick up the daily letter, he found it sticking out a little from under one corner of the wooden lid on the water jar, covered with a metal basin to keep the rain from wetting it. The rain continued during the entire day's fishing, but Shinji managed to read the letter during the noon rest by protecting it with his raincoat. Her handwriting was terribly difficult to read, and she explained that she was writing in her bed early in the morning, groping in the dark to avoid arousing her father's suspicions by turning on the light. Usually she wrote her letters at odd moments during the day and posted them before the fishing boats went out the next morning, but this morning, she wrote, she had something she wanted to tell him at once, so she had torn up the long letter she had written him yesterday and was writing this in its place. Hatsue's letter went on to say that she had had a lucky dream. In the dream, a god had told her that Shinji was a reincarnation of Prince Deki. Then they had been happily married and had had a jewel-like child. Shinji knew that Hatsue could not have known about his visit to Prince Deki's tomb the night before. He was so struck by this uncanny happening that he decided to write Hatsue at length when he got home that night and tell her this amazing proof of her dream's deep meaning. Now that Shinji was working to support the family, it was no longer necessary for his mother to go diving when the water was still cold. So she had decided to wait until June to start diving. But she had always been a hard worker, and now, as the weather became warm, she became dissatisfied, with nothing to do but the housework. Whenever she found herself unoccupied, she was apt to let herself become upset with all sorts of unnecessary worries. Her son's unhappiness was always on her mind. Shinji was now completely different from the person he had been 3 months before. He was as taciturn as ever, but the youthful gaiety that had lighted up his face, even when he was silent, was now extinguished. One day, she had finished her darning in the morning and was facing a boring afternoon. Idly, she began to wonder if there was not something she could do to relieve her son's misery. Theirs was not a sunny house, but over the roof of the next-door neighbor's godown, she could see the tranquil sky of late spring. Making up her mind, she left the house. She went directly to the breakwater and stood there watching the waves as they dashed themselves to pieces. Like her son, she too went to take counsel with the sea whenever she had something to think about. The breakwater was covered with the ropes of the octopus pots spread there to dry. The beach, too, now almost empty of boats, was spread with drying nets. The mother caught sight of a lone butterfly that came flying capriciously from the outspread nets toward the breakwater. It was a large and beautiful black swallowtail. Perhaps the butterfly had come searching for some new and different flower here among the fishing tackle and sand and concrete. The fishermen's houses had no gardens worthy of the name, but only ragged flower beds along the narrow, stone-fenced paths, and the butterfly had apparently come to the beach, disgusted with their niggling blossoms. Beyond the breakwater, the waves were always churning up the bottom of the sea, and the water was a muddy yellow-green. And as the waves rolled in, the muddiness was chopped into patterns of tossing bamboo leaves. Presently, the mother saw the butterfly take off from the breakwater and fly close to the surface of the muddy water. There, it seemed to rest its wings a moment, and then it soared high into the air again. "What a strange butterfly," she told herself. "It's imitating a seagull." And at the thought, her attention became riveted upon the butterfly. Soaring high, the butterfly was trying to fly away from the island, directly into the sea breeze. Mild though it seemed, the breeze tore at the butterfly's tender wings. In spite of it, however, the butterfly, high in the air, finally got clear of the island. The mother stared until it was only a black speck against the dazzling sky. For a long time, the butterfly continued to flutter there in one corner of her field of vision, and then flying low and hesitantly over the surface of the water, it returned to the breakwater, bewitched by the wideness and glitter of the sea, doubtless driven to despair by the way the next island looked so close and was yet so far. The butterfly added what appeared to be the shadow of a large knot to the shadow made by one of the drying ropes and rested its wings. The mother was not one to put faith in signs and superstitions, and yet the butterfly's futile labor cast a shadow over her heart. "Foolish butterfly! And if it wants to get away, all it has to do is perch on the ferry boat and go in style." And yet she herself, having no business in the world outside the island, had not been on the ferry boat now for many, many years. At this moment, for some reason, a reckless courage was born within her heart. With firm steps, she strode quickly from the breakwater. A diving woman greeted her along the way and was surprised when Shinji's mother walked steadily on as though deep in thought, not even returning the greeting.
Terukichi Miyata was one of the richest men in the village. Of course, about all that could be said of his house was that it was a bit newer than the other village houses. Otherwise, it could not even be said that its tile roof towered in particular above the houses around it. The house had neither an outer gate nor a stone wall, nor was it different from the other houses in its arrangement. The hole for ladling out night soil was to the left of the main door, and the kitchen window to the right, both insisting majestically upon their equal rank, precisely in the same way the ministers of the left and right occupied their seats of honor at either side of a doll festival arrangement. And yet, being built on a slope, the house did derive a certain air of stability from a stoutly constructed concrete basement on the lower level where the slope dropped away. This was used as a storeroom and had windows opening directly on the narrow road. Beside the kitchen door, there was a water jar large enough for a man to crawl into. Its wooden lid, under which Hatsue left her letter each morning, gave the outward appearance of protecting the water from dust and dirt, but when summer came, it could not keep out the mosquitoes and other flying insects whose dead bodies would suddenly be found floating on the water in the jar. Shinji's mother hesitated a moment as she was about to enter the house. Just the fact that she had come calling at the Miyata house, where she was not on intimate terms, would be enough to set the villagers' tongues to wagging. She looked about. There was not a human form to be seen. There was nothing but a few chickens scratching in the alley, and the color of the sea below glimpsed through the scanty azalea blossoms of the next house. The mother put her hand on her hair and, finding it still disarranged from the sea breeze, took from her bosom a small, red celluloid comb with several teeth missing and quickly combed her hair. She was wearing her everyday work clothes. Beneath her face, which was bare of any makeup, there was the beginning of her sunburnt chest. Then came her kimono-like jacket and bloomer-like work pants, both with many patches, and the wooden clogs on her bare feet. Her toes had been toughened by the repeated cuts and bruises they had received from the diving woman's customary way of always kicking off against the floor of the sea when ready to surface, and the nails were thick and badly twisted. Her feet could in no way have been called beautiful, but when planted on the earth, they were firm and unshakable. She opened the door and entered the central workroom. Several pairs of clogs had been taken off and dropped pell-mell on the earthen floor, one lying upside down. A pair with red thongs seemed to have just returned from a trip to the sea, wet sand in the shape of footprints still clinging to the surface of each clog. The house was filled with silence, and the odor of the toilet floated on the air. The rooms opening off the earthen floor were dark, but sunlight was streaming in through a window somewhere at the back of the house and had spread a bright patch, like a saffron-colored wrapping cloth, in the middle of the floor of one of the farther rooms. "Good day," the mother called. She waited a while. There was no answer. She called again. Hatsue came down the ladder-like steps at the side of the earth-floored room. "Why, Auntie," she said. She was wearing quiet-colored work pants, and her hair was tied with a yellow ribbon. "That's a pretty ribbon," the mother complimented her. As she spoke, she made a thorough inspection of this girl for whom her son was so lovesick. It may have been her imagination, but Hatsue's face seemed a little haggard, her complexion a little pale. And because of this, her black eyes, clear and shining, seemed all the more prominent. Becoming aware of the other's scrutiny, Hatsue blushed. The mother was firm in her courage. She would meet Terukichi, champion her son's innocence, lay bare her heart, and get the two married. The only solution to the situation was for the two parents to talk it over face to face. "Is your father at home?"
"Yes, he is."
"I've something to talk over with him. Will you please tell him so?"
"Just a minute."
Hatsue climbed the stairs, an uneasy expression on her face. The mother took a seat on the step leading up from the earthen room into the house proper. She waited a long time, wishing she had brought cigarettes with her. And as she waited, her courage drooped. She began to realize what folly her imagination had led her into. The stairs creaked softly as Hatsue started down, but she did not come all the way. She called from mid-stairs, seeming to bend her body slightly. The stairs were dark, and her face could not be seen clearly as she looked down.
Father says he won't see you.
He won't see me?
That's right, but...
With this reply, the mother's courage was utterly crushed, and her feeling of humiliation spurred her to a fit of passion. In a flash, she recalled her long life of sweat and toil, all the hardships she had faced as a widow. Then, in a tone of voice that sounded as though she were spitting in someone's face, but not until she was already half out the front door, she bawled out,
"All right, then. So you say you don't want to see a poor widow. You mean you don't want me to cross your threshold ever again. Well, let me tell you something, and you tell that father of yours here. Tell him, I said it first, that never in my life will I ever cross his damn threshold again."
The mother could not bring herself to tell her son about this fiasco of hers. Looking for a scapegoat, she turned her spite against Hatsue and said such bad things about her that, instead of having helped her son, she had a quarrel with him. Mother and son did not speak to each other for one whole day, but then the next day they made up. Thereupon the mother, suddenly overcome with the desire for her son's sympathy, told him all about her abortive call on Terukichi. As for Shinji, he had already learned of it from one of Hatsue's letters. In her confession, the mother omitted the final scene, in which she had spewed forth those outrageous parting words of hers, and Hatsue's letter also, out of consideration for Shinji's feelings, had made no mention of this. So for Shinji, there was nothing but the smarting thought of how his mother had had to eat the humiliation of being turned away from Terukichi's door. And the soft-hearted boy told himself that, even if he could not agree with the bad things his mother said about Hatsue, still, he could not blame her for saying them. Until now, he had never tried to hide his love for Hatsue from his mother, but he made up his mind that henceforth he must never confide in anyone except the master and Ryuji. It was out of devotion for his mother that he made this decision. Thus, it came about that, because she had tried to do a good deed and failed, the mother was lonelier than ever. It was fortunate that there was not a single day of rest from fishing, for if there had been, it would have served only to make him bemoan the tedium of a day in which he could not meet Hatsue. Thus the month of May came, and their meetings were still prohibited. Then one day, Ryuji brought a letter which made Shinji wild with joy.
"Tomorrow night, for a wonder, father is having visitors. There's some prefectural officials from Tsu, and will spend the night. Whenever father has guests, he always drinks a lot and goes to bed early. So I think it'll be safe for me to slip out of the house about 11 o'clock. Please wait for me in front of Yashiro Shrine."
When Shinji returned from fishing that day, he changed into a new shirt. His mother, given no explanation, sat looking up at him nervously. She felt as though she were once more looking at her son on that day of the storm. Shinji had now learned well enough the pain of waiting, so he decided it would be better if he let the girl do the waiting this time. But he could not do it. As soon as his mother and Hiroshi were in bed, he went out. It still lacked 2 hours of 11 o'clock. He thought maybe he could kill the time by going to the Young Men's Association. Light was shining from the windows of the hut on the beach, and he could hear the voices of the boys who were sleeping there. But then he had the feeling that they were gossiping about him, and he went on by. Going out onto the nighttime breakwater, the boy turned his face to the sea breeze. As he did so, he recalled the white ship he had seen sailing against the background of sunset clouds on the horizon that day when he had first learned Hatsue's identity from Jukichi, recalled the strange feeling he had had as he watched the ship sail away. That had been the unknown. So long as he had observed the unknown from a distance, his heart had been peaceful. But once he himself had boarded the unknown and set sail, uneasiness and despair, confusion and anguish had joined forces and borne down upon him. He believed he knew the reason why his heart, which should have been filled with joy at this moment, was instead crushed and unable to move. The Hatsue whom he would meet tonight would probably insist upon some hasty solution or other to their problem. Elopement? But they were living on an isolated island, and if they were to flee by boat, Shinji had no boat of his own, nor, even more important, did he have any money. Double suicide, then? Even on this island, there had been lovers who took that solution. But the boy's good sense repudiated the thought, and he told himself that those others had been selfish persons who thought only of themselves. Never once had he thought about such a thing as dying, and above all, there was his family to support. While he had been pondering these matters, time had moved ahead surprisingly fast. This boy, who was so inexpert at thinking, was surprised to discover that one of the expected properties of thought was its efficacy as a time killer. Nevertheless, the strong-willed young man abruptly turned off his thoughts. No matter how efficacious it might be, what he had discovered above all else about this new habit of thinking was that it also comprised point-blank peril. Shinji did not have a watch. As a matter of fact, he needed one. In its place, he was endowed with the marvelous ability of being able to sense what time it was instinctively, day or night. For instance, the stars moved, and even if he was not an expert at measuring their changes precisely, still his body perceived the turning of the immense wheel of the night, the revolution of the giant wheel of the day. Placed as he was, close to the workings of nature, it was not surprising that he should understand nature's precise system. But, to tell the truth, as he sat on the stairs at the entrance to the office of Yashiro Shrine, he had already heard the clock give the single stroke of the half hour and so was doubly sure it was past 10:30. The priest and his family were fast asleep. Now the boy pressed his ear to the night shutters of the house and counted, at full length, the 11 strokes that sounded lonesomely from the wall clock inside. The boy stood up and, passing through the dark shadows of the pine trees, came to a stop at the top of the flight of 200 stone steps leading downward to the village. There was no moon, thin clouds covered the sky, and only an occasional star was to be seen. And yet, the limestone steps gathered together every last gleam of the night's faint light and, looking like some immense majestic cataract, fell away from the spot where Shinji stood. The vast expanse of the Gulf of Ise was completely hidden by the night, but lights could be seen on the farther shores, sparse along the Chita and Atsumi peninsulas, but beautifully and thickly clustered about the city of Ujiyamada. The boy was proud of the brand new shirt he was wearing. He felt sure that its unparalleled whiteness would immediately catch the eye even from the bottommost of the 200 steps. About halfway down the stone steps, there crouched a black shadow, caused by the pine branches that hung over both sides of the stairway there. A human figure came into view at the bottom of the steps, looking very small. Shinji's heart pounded with joy. The sound of the wooden clogs running determinedly up the steps echoed with a loudness out of all proportion to the smallness of the figure. The footsteps sounded tireless. Shinji resisted the desire to run down the steps to meet her. After all, since he had waited so long, he had the right to stay calmly at the top. Probably, however, when she came close enough for him to see her face, the only way he could keep from shouting her name in a loud voice would be to go running down to her. When would he be able to see her face clearly? At about the 100th step? What? At that instant, Shinji heard a strange roar of anger from below. The voice seemed for certain to be calling Hatsue's name. Hatsue came to an abrupt halt on the 100th step, which was slightly wider than the others. He could see her breast moving. Her father came out of the shadows where he had been hiding. He caught his daughter by the wrist, and Shinji watched them exchange a few violent words. He stood motionless at the top of the steps as though bound there. Terukichi never once so much as glanced in Shinji's direction. Still holding his daughter's wrist, he started down the steps. Not knowing what he ought to do and feeling as though even his head was half paralyzed, the boy continued to stand in the same motionless posture, like a sentinel at the top of the stone steps. The figures of the father and daughter reached the bottom of the steps, turned to the right, and disappeared from view.
Chapter 13. The young girls of the island faced the arrival of the diving season with precisely the same heart-strangling feeling city youths have when confronted by final school term examinations. Their games of scrambling for pebbles on the bottom of the sea close to the beach, begun during the early years of grade school, first introduced them to the art of diving, and they naturally became more skillful as their spirit of rivalry increased. But when they finally began diving for a living, and their carefree games turned into real work, without exception, the young girls became frightened, and the arrival of spring meant only that the dreaded summer was approaching. There was the cold, the strangling feeling of running out of breath, the inexpressible agony when water forced its way under the water goggles, the panic and sudden fear of collapsing that invaded the entire body just when an abalone was almost at the fingertips. There were also all kinds of accidents, and the wounds inflicted on the tips of the toes when kicking off against the sea's bottom with its carpet of sharp-edged shells to rise to the surface, and the leaden languor that possessed the body after it had been forced to dive almost beyond endurance. All these things had become sharper and sharper in the remembering. The terror had become all the more intense in the repeating. And often sudden nightmares would awaken the girls from sleep so deep as seemingly to leave no room for dreams to creep in. Then, in the dead of the night, in the darkness surrounding their peaceful, dangerless beds, they would peer at the flood of sweat clenched within their fists. It was different with the older divers, with those who had husbands. Coming out of the water from diving, they would sing and laugh and talk in loud voices. It seemed as though work and play had become united in a single whole for them. Watching them enviously, the young girls would tell themselves that they could never become like that. And yet, as the years passed, they would be surprised to discover that, without their quite realizing it, they themselves had reached the point where they too could be counted among those light-hearted, veteran divers. The divers of Utajima were at their busiest during June and July. Their operations centered about Garden Beach, on the eastern side of Benten Promontory. One day, before the onset of the rainy season, the beach lay under a strong noonday sun that could no longer be called that of early summer. A drying fire had been lit, and a southerly breeze was carrying its smoke in the direction of the ancient grave mound of Prince Deki. Garden Beach embraced a small cove, directly beyond which there stretched the Pacific. Summer clouds were towering over the distant sea. As its name suggested, Niwahama, Garden Beach, did indeed have the qualities of a landscaped park. Many limestone crags surrounded the beach, seeming to have been arranged purposely in order that children could hide themselves and fire their pistols in games of cowboys and Indians. Moreover, the surfaces of the rocks were smooth to the touch, with occasional finger-sized holes as dwellings for crabs and sea lice. The sand held in the arms of these crags was pure white. Atop the cliff facing the sea to the left, the flowers called beach cotton were in full bloom. Their blossoms were not those of the season's end, looking like disheveled sleepers, but were vividly white petals, sensuous and leek-like, brandished against the cobalt sky. It was the noonday rest period, and the area around the fire was noisy with laughing banter. The sand was not yet so hot as to scorch the soles of the feet, and, though cold, the water was no longer of that freezing temperature that made the divers rush to put on their padded garments and huddle around the fire the minute they emerged from the sea. Laughing boisterously, all the divers were thrusting out their chests, boastfully exhibiting their breasts. One of them started to lift her breasts in both hands.
"No, no, it's no fair using your hands. There's no telling how much you might cheat if you used your hands."
"Listen who's talking. Why, with those breasts of yours, you couldn't even cheat if you did use your hands."
Everybody laughed. They were arguing as to who had the best-shaped breasts. All of their breasts were well-tanned, and if they lacked the quality of mysterious whiteness, still less did they have the transparent skin that reveals a tracery of veins. Judging merely by the skin, there seemed to be no particular indication of any sensitivity. But beneath the sunburned skin, the sun had created a lustrous, semi-transparent color like that of honey. The dark areolas of the nipples did not stand out as isolated spots of black, moist mystery, but instead shaded off gradually into this honey color. Among the many breasts jostling around the fire, there were some which had already hung slack, and others whose last vestiges remained only in form of dry, hard nipples. But in most cases, there were well-developed pectoral muscles, which supported the breasts on firm, wide chests, without letting them droop under their own weight. Their appearance bespoke the fact that these breasts had developed each day beneath the sun, without any knowledge of shame, like ripening fruit. One of the girls lamented the fact that one of her breasts was smaller than the other, but an outspoken old woman consoled her.
"That's nothing to worry about. Any day now, there'll be some handsome young swain to pet them into shape for you."
Everyone laughed again, but the girl seemed to be worried.
"Are you sure, Grandma O'Hara?" she asked.
"I'm sure. I knew a girl like that once before, but once she got herself a man, her breasts evened right up."
Shinji's mother was proud of the fact that her own breasts were still young and fresh, the most youthful among the married women of her age. As though they had never known the hunger of love or the pains of life, all summer long her breasts turned their faces toward the sun, deriving there, firsthand, their inexhaustible strength. The breasts of the young girls did not particularly arouse her jealousy. There was, however, one beautiful pair that had become the object of everyone's admiration, including that of Shinji's mother. These were the breasts of Hatsue. This was the first day Shinji's mother had come out to dive, so it was also her first opportunity to have a leisurely look at Hatsue. Even after she had hurled those insulting parting words at Hatsue, they had kept exchanging nods whenever they happened to meet, but Hatsue was by nature not a talkative person. Today again, they had been busy with one thing and another, and had not had many opportunities for speaking with each other. Even now, during the breast-beautiful contest, it was mainly the older women who were doing all the talking, and so Shinji's mother, already prejudiced anyway, purposely avoided getting into conversation with Hatsue. But when she looked at Hatsue's breasts, she nodded to herself, understanding why, with the passage of time, the ugly rumor about the girl and Shinji had died out. No woman who saw those breasts could have any more doubts. Not only were they the breasts of a girl who had never known a man, but they had just begun to bloom, making one think how beautiful they would be once they were in full flower. Between two small mounds that held on high their rose-colored buds, there was a valley that, though darkly burned by the sun, still had not lost the delicacy, the smoothness, the veined coolness of skin. A valley fragrant with thoughts of early spring. Keeping pace with the normal growth of the rest of her body, her breasts were in no way late in their development. Yet their roundness, still tinged with the firmness of childhood, seemed on the verge of awakening from sleep, seemed ready to come awake at the slightest touch of a feather, at the caress of the slightest breeze. The old grandmother could not resist the impulse to lay her hand against the nipples of these breasts that were so healthily virginal and at the same time so exquisitely formed. The touch of her rough palm made Hatsue jump to her feet. Everyone laughed.
"So now do you understand how men must feel about them, Grandma Ohara?" someone asked.
The old woman rubbed her own wrinkle-covered breasts with both hands and then spoke in a crackling voice,
"What are you talking about? Hers are just green peaches, but mine are well-seasoned pickles. They've soaked up a lot of delicious flavor, let me tell you."
Hatsue laughed and tossed her head. A piece of green, transparent seaweed fell from her hair to the dazzling sand. While they were all eating their lunches, a favorite man of theirs suddenly appeared from behind some rocks where he had been awaiting what he knew would be the propitious moment. The women all screamed for the sake of screaming, put their lunches back into the bamboo leaf wrappers on the ground beside them, and covered their breasts. Actually, they were not in the slightest taken aback. The intruder was an old peddler who made his way to the island every season, and their pretense at bashfulness was nothing but their way of poking fun at his old age. The old man was wearing a seedy pair of trousers and a white, open-necked shirt. He put down on a rock the big cloth-wrapped bundle he was carrying on his back and wiped the sweat from his face.
"I guess I gave you an awful scare, didn't I? Maybe it was wrong of me to come like this. Shall I go away?"
The peddler said this in full confidence that they would never let him go. He well knew that there was no better way of arousing the diver's desire to buy than by exhibiting his goods here on the beach. The divers always felt bold and open-handed when they were beside the sea. So he would have them choose what they wanted to buy here, and then the same night he would deliver the goods to their homes and collect his money. The women, too, liked it this way because they could judge colors better in the sunlight. The old peddler spread his wares out in the shade of some rocks. Still cramming the lunches into their mouths, the women crowded around the display. There were lengths of stencil-dyed cotton material for summer kimonos. There were light house dresses and children's clothes. There were unlined sashes, underpants, undershirts, and sash strings. The peddler took the lid off a flat wooden box, and cries of admiration escaped from the women's mouths. The box was filled to overflowing with beautiful notions. Coin purses, clog thongs, plastic handbags, ribbons, brooches, and the like, all in assorted colors.
"There's not a thing here I wouldn't like to have," one of the young divers truthfully remarked.
In a flash, many sun-blackened fingers reached out. The goods were painstakingly examined and criticized. Arguments broke out among the women as to whether something was or was not becoming to so-and-so, and half-joking bargaining grew apace. As a result, the peddler sold two lengths of summer kimono material in tawdry, towel-like patterns at almost 1,000 yen each, as well as one unlined sash of a mixed weave and a large amount of sundry merchandise. Shinji's mother bought a plastic shopping bag for 200 yen. And Hatsue bought a length of the better cotton kimono material in a youthful pattern of dark blue morning glories on a white background. The old peddler was pleased with all this unexpectedly good business. He was quite gaunt, and his sunburned ribs could be seen through the open collar of his shirt. His pepper and salt hair was cut short, and the years had deposited a number of dark splotches on his cheeks and temples. He had only a few straggling tobacco-stained teeth, which made it difficult to understand what he said, and still more so now when he raised his voice loudly. Nevertheless, by the laughter that made his cheeks tremble as though with a twitch, and by his exaggerated gestures, the women realized that the peddler was about to render them some magnificent service, quite apart from any desire for gain. With scurrying fingers, he had let the nail grow long on the little finger of each hand, the peddler produced three beautiful plastic handbags from the box of notions.
"Look! This blue one is for young ladies, this brown for the middle-aged, and this black for ladies of advanced years."
"I'll take the young ladies one," the same old woman broke in,
and everyone laughed, causing the peddler to raise his quavering voice still higher.
"Plastic handbags of the very latest fashion. Fixed price, 800 yen.
Oh, they're dear, aren't they? Of course, he's padded the price.
No, no, 800 yen without any padding at all. And I'm going to present one of these beautiful handbags to one of you ladies as a token of my appreciation for your kind patronage. Absolutely free."
Dozens of guileless open hands were simultaneously stretched forth, but the old man brushed them aside with a flourish.
"One," I said, "just one. It's the Omiya Prize, a sort of sacrificial service rendered by my shop, the Omiya Shop, in celebration of the prosperity of Utajima Village. We'll have a contest, and one of these bags shall go to whoever wins. The blue, if the victor is young. The brown, if it's a middle-aged lady."
The diving women were holding their breath. Each was thinking that, with just a little luck, she would receive an 800-yen handbag for nothing. The peddler had once been a grade school principal and often brooded over having come to his present humble circumstances because of a mess he had gotten into with a woman. But now the diver's silence gave him new confidence in his ability to win people's hearts, and once again he told himself that he would quit peddling and become an athletic director.
"Well then, if we're to have a contest, it ought to be something for the good of Utajima Village, to which I owe so much. How about it, everyone? What would you say to an abalone contest? And to the person who brings up the biggest catch in the next hour, I'll present the prize."
Ceremoniously, he spread a cloth in the shade of another rock and gravely decked it with the prizes. To tell the truth, not one of the handbags was worth more than about 500 yen, but they looked worth fully 800. The youthful prize was sky blue and box-shaped, and its cobalt color, bright as a new-built boat, made an inexpressibly lovely contrast with its glittering gold-plated clasp. The brown, middle-aged one was also box-shaped, and its ostrich skin pattern had been so exceedingly well-pressed into the plastic that at first glance one could not tell whether it was genuine ostrich skin or not. Only the black one, for old ladies, was not box-shaped, but with its long and slender golden clasp and its oblong boat shape, it was indeed a tasteful, refined piece of workmanship. Shinji's mother, who wanted the brown, middle-aged bag, was the first to announce her name for the contest. The second person who called out her name was Hatsue. Carrying the eight divers who had entered the contest, the boat pulled away from the shore. A fat, middle-aged woman, who had not entered the contest, stood in the stern and sculled. Of the eight, Hatsue was the only young girl. All the other girls had held back, knowing they could not win anyway. They were cheering for Hatsue. As for the other women left on the beach, each was shouting encouragement to her own favorite. The boat took a southward course along the beach and moved away to the eastern side of the island. The divers who were left behind gathered around the old peddler and sang songs. The water in the cove was clear and blue, and when the waves were still, one could plainly see the round rocks on the bottom, covered with red seaweed and looking as though they were floating close to the surface. Actually, however, they were deeply submerged. The waves swelled large at this point, throwing shadows of their patterns and refractions of froth over the rocks on the ocean floor as they passed over them. Then, no sooner had a wave risen full than it smashed itself to pieces on the beach. Thereupon, a reverberation like that of a deep sigh would overflow the entire beach and drown out the women singing. An hour later, the boat returned from the eastern side of the island. Many times more exhausted than usual because of the competition, the eight divers sat silent in the boat, leaning against one another, each staring out toward whatever direction her eyes happened to fancy. Their wet, disheveled hair was so tangled together that it was impossible to tell one diver's hair from that of her neighbor's. Two of them were hugging each other to keep warm. All their breasts were covered with goose flesh, and in the too brilliant sunshine, Even their naked, sunburned bodies seemed to turn pale, making them look like a group of pallid, drowned corpses. The noisy reception they received from the beach was out of keeping with the quietness of this boat that moved so soundlessly forward. The moment they were on land, the eight women collapsed on the sand around the fire and would not even speak. The peddler checked the contents of the buckets he had collected from the divers. When he was done, he called out the results in a loud voice.
Hatsue-san is first, 20 abalone, and the mistress of the Kubo family is second, 18.
The winner and the runner-up, Hatsue and Shinji's mother, exchanged glances out of tired, bloodshot eyes. The island's most expert diver had been bested by a girl who had learned her skill from the divers of another island. Hatsue got to her feet in silence and went around the rock to receive her prize. And the prize she returned with was the brown, middle-aged handbag, which she pressed into the hands of Shinji's mother. The mother's cheeks flushed red with delight.
But why? Because I've always wanted to apologize ever since my father spoke so rudely to Auntie that day.
She's a fine girl,
the peddler shouted, and when everyone joined in with unanimous praise of Hatsue, urging the older woman to accept the girl's kindness, Shinji's mother took the brown handbag, wrapped it carefully in a piece of paper, clasped it under a bare arm, and spoke quite casually,
Why, thanks.
The mother's simple, straightforward heart had immediately understood the modesty and respect behind the girl's gesture. Hatsue smiled, and Shinji's mother told herself how wise her son had been in his choice of a bride. And it was in this same fashion that the politics of the island were always conducted. Chapter 14. For Shinji, the rainy season brought only one bitter day after another. Even Hatsue's letters had ceased. Doubtless, after her father had frustrated their meeting at Yashiro Shrine, which he had probably learned about by reading her letter, he had absolutely forbidden Hatsue to write again. One day, before the end of the rains, the captain of the Utajima Maru came to the island. The Utajima Maru was the larger of Terukichi Miyata's two coasting freighters and was now anchored at Toba. The captain went first to Terukichi's house and next to Yasuo's. The same night he went to see Shinji's boss, Jukichi, and then at last went to Shinji's house. The captain was a few years past 40 and had 3 children. He was a man of big stature and proud of his strength, but he had a gentle disposition. He was a zealous member of the Nichiren sect, and if he happened to be on the island at the time of the Lantern Festival, he would always officiate as a sort of lay priest in reading the sutras for the repose of the souls of the dead. He had women in various ports, whom his crew referred to as the Yokohama Aunt, the Moji Aunt, and the like. Whenever the ship called at one of these ports, the captain would take the young crew members along to his woman's place for a drink. The aunts all dressed conservatively and always treated the young men with great kindness. The gossip was that the captain's half-bald head was the result of his debaucheries. This was the reason he always maintained his dignity with a gold-braided uniform cap. As soon as the captain reached the house, he began discussing his business with Shinji's mother. Shinji, too, was present. When the boys of the village reached the age of 17 or 18, they began their maritime training in the capacity of rice rinsers, the local word for apprentice seamen. And Shinji was at the age to be thinking about it. The captain asked if he would like to join the Utajima Maru as a rice rinser. The mother was silent, and Shinji replied that he would give his answer after he had a chance to discuss it with Jukichi, his boss. The captain said that if it was a question of Jukichi's approval, he had already secured that. But still, there was something strange about it all. The Utajima Maru belonged to Terukichi, and there certainly was no reason for him to employ Shinji, whom he disliked so much, as a crew member on one of his own ships.
No, Uncle Teru himself sees that you'll make a good sailor. As soon as I mentioned you, Uncle Teru agreed. So come on, then. Do your best and work hard.
To make sure it was all right, Shinji accompanied the captain to Jukichi's house, and Jukichi also strongly urged Shinji to take the job. He said it would be a bit difficult on the Taihei-maru without Shinji, but that he couldn't stand in the way of the boy's future. So Shinji agreed. The next